The independent art scene here in Atlanta is strong and growing all the time, and this isn't something that began overnight, as our next guest could tell you. Alice Lovelace is a cultural worker, writer, and arts administrator who has been active in the arts in Atlanta since the mid-1970s. She worked with the long-running Neighborhood Arts Center and was a founding member of the Arts Exchange, just to name a couple entries in her impressive resume. Lovelace is one of the subjects of an exhibit at Kennesaw State University's Zuckerman Museum of Art. It's called Atlas, and it collects oral histories of local arts organizations primarily run by women in the 1970s in order to map out a side of Atlanta which may be forgotten or overlooked. She sat down with us in the WABE studios to talk about the culture of Atlanta's art scene at that time and how she came to call Atlanta home. So Alice, you've been working in the various artistic communities of Atlanta since the mid-1970s. But you're originally from St. Louis.
Yes.
What brought you to Atlanta?
In a way, Maynard Jackson brought me to Atlanta. We were planning to move to California. My fiancé and I both were writers, and we thought, we want to write for the film. So we, you know, put away everything in storage, informed out the kids. And the morning before we were to leave, we woke up that morning, we always watched the Today Show, and there was Maynard down at the Omni Hotel, standing on that long escalator going up to the world of Sid and Marty Krofft, and he was talking about the New South. He's talking about how things were changing and how he needed people to come who wanted to build a New South. And we just kind of looked at each other and said, wow, that sounds like it's exciting. You know, we didn't know anyone in California. We didn't know anyone in Atlanta. So we took a chance and we came. We were driving a 1957 Army carry-all, camouflage green, that broke down on us about 50 miles out of St. Louis. So it took us about 4 days to get to Atlanta.
Wow. And once you were here, the Maynard Jackson's promise of a New South, how did that pan out?
Well, probably because I wasn't raised in the South, even though both of my parents are from the South, and not having experienced the old South, I liked Atlanta a lot. I liked what we found here. It was like night and day between Atlanta and St. Louis. St. Louis was the kind of town that for me was a you can't do that town. Atlanta, everybody you spoke to and you would tell them, well, you know, I was thinking about doing this, or I was thinking how would it work out. Everybody would say, yeah, that's a good idea. You should try that. And this was very much a anything could happen town. Yeah, so Maynard, I think, was right.
So where was your first stop artistically here?
You know, the first place that I found which opened thousands of doors for me. I was coming home from work. I got off late one night, and when the bus pulled up to the corner of Georgia Avenue and Pryor Street, the bus driver opened the doors, and all you could hear were these West African drums. And I had no idea where I was. I got off the bus, and I just started walking. I ended up at the Neighborhood Arts Center, and it was the beginning of an extraordinary adventure.
Now, the Neighborhood Arts Center, this is something that it's no longer around, correct?
No.
Tell me about what the Neighborhood Arts Center was.
Neighborhood Arts Center was in Mechanicsville. It was a former elementary school. It was actually started with assistance, a lot of assistance from Maynard Jackson and the city administration. There was a small art center here called, that was a black arts center, Center for the Black Arts. And was attracting very high-profile black artists here to Atlanta who were also attracted to Maynard. And so Maynard decided that there needed to be a larger home. And then that's how the school and the program transitioned into the school. It served not only that neighborhood with community-based classes, but it inspired many of the people that you see today. A lot of the black actors on Broadway came through there, filmmakers, dancers. It was a very pivotal institution in the black arts community.
You worked there as a writer in residence and a director, correct?
Yes. Later, I started as a writer in residence. I actually first started not as a employee, but as a volunteer, because I met Ebon Dooley, who was writer in residence, and I met Tony Cade Bambara. And Tony and Ebon were talking about starting a regional writers organization. So I started coming to the meetings and working with them. And as it grew and grew, I sort of took on the mantle of organizing the Southern Collective of African American Writers, with Tony as the sort of lead mentor and door opener. And it was after that, that I then came onto the staff.
So introduce us to these two people that you mentioned just now, Tony Cade Bambara and Ebon Dooley.
Ebon Dooley was brilliant. He went to college at 14, Fisk University.
Wow.
He was an extraordinary writer, but I think Ebon was more committed to social justice. He loved the arts, but social justice were his calling. He got a law degree, but he never practiced law. But he became this, he became the lawyer to the arts community. So Ebon helped with all of the paperwork that actually founded WRFG Radio. He was one of the founders there. He also did a lot of the legal work and helped set up the Neighborhood Arts Center. When we moved into the Arts Exchange, it was Ebon who did all the legal work that got us set up and got us going. He was just an extraordinary person. Hardworking, dedicated, totally committed to art as a means of transforming society, and artists as cultural workers. And that's how I describe myself. I am a cultural worker.
How is that distinct from being an artist?
Because I use my work, my art, I use it in service to broader causes. It doesn't, in my mind, and my work, it doesn't diminish me as an artist. It merely confirms that I could not exist without a community that supported me, and therefore I must also support that community. So it always plays in all of the work that I do. I do a lot of organizing work. I had a lot of new organizations get started, wrote a lot of grants for artists and for organizations in order to get their programs rolling. And that was taught to me by Tony. Tony Kay was my mentor. I didn't take writing workshops from Tony, but Tony pulled me in, and I think she saw something in me that was a commitment to use my work for something larger than just self-aggrandizement. And she taught me then. She talked a lot about the responsibility of a writer, about writing wasn't just writing books and poems, that it was just important to write proposals that would help bring money into the community, just important that if Miss Lizzie was having trouble with the phone company, then she needed someone to sit and write that letter that detailed the problem so it could be solved, that was every bit as important as publishing a book. And I believed her, and I believe her still, and she gave me my marching orders.
What was it that made the Neighborhood Arts Center, the NAC, stand out among the other arts organizations in Atlanta?
One, I think it was its profound community-based mission. A lot of the art centers operated for the sake of artists. And of course, we did too. You know, the CEDAR program was like a lifesaver back then. So the CEDAR program helped to staff the center. So you had professional artists in all disciplines working there in their studios. But at the Neighborhood Arts Center, in order to keep your studio, you had to also do community work. So you had to teach classes, and you had to outreach to the community. And we did summer arts programs for the children, and we did a lot of outreach into the neighborhood. And that definitely distinguished that from the other arts organizations.
Yeah. Can you give us a sense of what the arts community in Atlanta was like in the mid-70s and 80s? What were the most active organizations? Who were the major players?
Oh, my goodness.
This is a big question.
Only because there was so much going on. Atlanta was really blessed by the presence of Maynard Jackson, who had extraordinary foresight. So here's Maynard in this little town that's trying to be a big city, and he he says we're going to have a Department of International Art and Culture, not just Atlanta, you know. And this was the first iteration. It was a department. International was in the title because he fostered international exchanges. And he started artist-initiated grants, which was the greatest blessing that artists in the city ever had. And because Maynard was doing artist-initiated grants in the city, the state also decided to do artist-initiated grant. And what that meant was that everyday working artists do not have to wait for an organization to say, you are worthy, oh yeah, we'll give you this exhibit, or you are worthy, we'll let you perform at our spot. Artists could actually get together, come up with ideas of things they wanted to do, apply, get the money themselves, manage and control that money, and produce. And so there was a blossoming of theater companies and dance companies, and there were constant visual arts shows in all kinds of places that you'd never expect. It was a tremendous boon. Neighborhood Arts Center was born. Forest Avenue Consortium, which had been a photography consortium, then took over the school and became Nexus Art Center, which became more than the photography, theater, and dance and contemporary arts and visual arts.
Yeah, Nexus is now the
contemporary.
Yeah.
Yes, it kept going, and now it is the contemporary. You had the Village Writers Group, you had Southern Collective of African American Writers, you had the Phoenix Gallery. That's also when they founded the Dancers Collective. He had a really large dance community here with no home. People were making homes for themselves. They were making art, and it was just everywhere. You know, Renaissance Theater Company, Theatrical Outfit got started by a vagabond group of artists, seeing individual artists who came together and just liked each other, started producing plays. And out of that, we have now today Theatrical Outfit.
Yeah. I mean, this is... This is fascinating personally for me to hear about, being sort of embedded in the arts community of Atlanta contemporarily. Atlanta, it's a town that has seen a lot of turnover in the last few decades. How have you seen the arts community evolve since that boom time that you're describing?
In some ways, it's diminished. And in some ways, it's expanded. I think it has diminished because I do not believe, and this is totally my belief, that there are as many opportunities for artists, individual artists, that we had in the 70s and in the early 80s. But on the other hand, the young artists that I interact with now, that I come into contact with, they're creating organizations, not so much on the nonprofit model. They're doing a lot of for-profit. And then even the ones that aren't formally organizing are more entrepreneurs of the art, as opposed to what we were those big nonprofits, established space, you know, holding down a place. And they are more business-minded. You know, we came to the work service-minded. We felt, I think we were so privileged to be given a job in the arts through the CETA program. It really made you appreciate that you could make art. All someone would pay you. It wasn't much, but they would pay you to make art all day. So then doing service, it was like, of course, someone did this for me. Yeah, I'm gonna work in the community. I'm gonna go out on Saturdays and do classes for kids. And so, but I think the service element a bit, I worry that it's lost. I also worry, particularly when I hang out with writers and with the young poets, I worry that the audience is lost. I go to a lot of programs and I look around and I see a room full of artists. And I'm always going around making people nervous because I go, well, where are the people? And they go, oh, there's a lot of people here. I say, yeah, but they're all artists. Where are the people? Where's the community? Where are the people we're doing this work for? Where are the people that we're trying to show a different way or show them a vision that perhaps they haven't had before? Where are they? And, yeah, I get shut down a lot. But that does worry me, that it does seem to be more artists creating for artists.
Atlanta remains a fairly segregated city, both along racial and class lines. How can art help to bridge that gap?
Well, you know, see, that's not my Atlanta. And I know that on a level that is true. But the wonderful thing about coming here and not knowing anybody, I didn't know who I wasn't supposed to talk to. So I talked to everybody. And so I wound up involved in all of these undertakings with these white groups. But then I also had, you know, the white black community. And I worked with everybody. And so I found that very gratifying. So I guess what I'm saying is that if art is going to cross those lines, it's artists who have to cross those lines. How can art cross a line the artist won't cross? So we have to cross-pollinate communities, and we have to merge art forms, and we have to talk to each other, and we have to share each other's spaces and successes, and we have to help each other. That's the scene that I lived in the 70s and the 80s. In my naivete, I thought everybody lived there, but of course they didn't. But you know, when I was doing Southern Collective of African American Writers, at the same time, I was working with Village Writers Group. Village Writers Group was a white writers group that met up at Green's Tavern up at Emory University. But I was at their meetings. We would do exchanges. We would write about each other in our newsletters. When they would have a reading, they would invite me out. They would invite me to teach workshops. So I always found I was never pigeonholed. I never had cliques, and I was never afraid to cross a boundary. If there was someone I wanted to know, something I wanted to do, I just did it. And I invite artists today to stop thinking of themselves as being one-dimensional. That I do believe that I and all artists in the essence of creating, we are the essence of humanity. And if the essence of humanity is to create, then we have to be open and we have to go where the art takes us. I would like to see a lot more adventurous things happening in the arts. I do see it closing up. I do see it becoming much more of a segregated scene. And there are fewer and fewer places that I go now that I see that cross-pollination.
Part of the reason that I'm talking to you today is because you you are one of the women who is the focus of this this exhibit at Kennesaw State University called Atlas, which focuses on the contributions of primarily women in the Atlanta arts scene throughout the 1970s and 80s. Can you talk about the importance of an arts scene looking back on its history and sort of understanding where it's been, especially here in Atlanta, where, as I said, there's a lot of turnover in the communities and a lot of new things happening now.
And it's interesting because, you know, Atlanta hates history. It really does. Atlanta really believes it's a phoenix. So about every 10 years, it sort of scraps everything and starts anew. So you find, you know, in the arts community, the current contemporary arts community, there's very few people who understand anything about there being a foundation of the arts. It was something that even I had to learn. I had to learn when I came here that it didn't start with Maynard and the Neighborhood Arts Center. I then was introduced to a lot of the people who had been doing this since the 30s and the 40s and understood whose shoulders we stood on. These young people don't care about whose shoulders they stand on. They create the world new every day for themselves. So you're with young people and they say things about, we're going to do something that's never been done in Atlanta before. And I kind of laugh because I know there's not much that's never been done in Atlanta before. I don't know. You know, those of us who were here through the 60s, 70s, 80s and helped to build that scene often talk about the necessity of having some sort of a big event, just sort of like a history teach-in, not because we want to be remembered, but we want the camaraderie, the fierceness, the community connection of those times. We don't want those things lost. We don't want lost the fact that it was artists who built these organizations, not businessmen, not bankers, not politicians. These were working artists who built these institutions. So it's also something about a respect for the expertise of the artist that goes beyond art making, that we also know how to build institutions.
How do we get back what we've lost?
Funding has to be restored. Funding has been cut so critically across this country, from the NEA to the state to Fulton County and the city, and even some states where they've simply disbanded their arts councils altogether. Funding has to be restored. You cannot have a living art without living artists. Living artists are messy. Sometimes we do things that the establishment doesn't like. It's part of a growth process. It's how you grow into greatness. They cannot be afraid to fund individual artists. They cannot be afraid that artists may do something embarrassing, because artists will also do something very, very great.
I mean, do you think that's why we're seeing, or why you're seeing the sort of rise of entrepreneurial artists, because with the lack of funding, young artists need to make do for themselves,
and they don't want the bureaucracy of the paperwork. When you're a nonprofit, there is a lot of bureaucracy and paperwork. When you get funding from state and federal sources, there's a lot of accountability, and I think that's what they're shunning. They're shunning the trappings, and they're finding a way around it. Plus, they've discovered, like a lot of us who are established, that getting the money is harder to get. There's less of it. You're still jumping through the same hoops, but there's less of it. Funding has to be restored for the arts. And as a nation, we have to understand the greatness of this. You know, we always talking about Europe, always pointing at Europe as these examples of art, but we fail to look at how they fund their artists as well. You know, I've sat on several panels funding for international arts, or funding Minnesota. Mm-hmm. Love to go there. You know, you sit down and here you've got $400,000 to give to artists. Give to them. They don't have to do a project. They don't have to do anything. You go through the proposals. You pick 15 artists. You split up the money. This is theirs to create for a year. They do it for writers. They do it for visual artists. They do it for dancers. One of the most well-funded art scenes I have ever seen. Why can't we do it? Why don't we value it?
Alice Lovelace, it's been really fantastic talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. It's nice reminiscing sometimes.
Yeah.